Tuesday, December 13th, opening the House Interim Task Force on the Oregon Health Plan. And we have the organizational meeting this morning to start with. I want to welcome everyone that's here and appreciate Representative Dalto is on the phone with us this morning. Good morning, Billy. How are you?
Good morning,
this morning?
Mr. Chairman. Yes.
It's good to have you here.
Thank you.
And we'll look forward to your just hollering anytime you want to. I can't see you wave your hand, so if you just holler, we'll stop for you.
Thank you.
And, and my co-chair, Representative Hannah, is here. Welcome, Bruce.
Good morning.
Any comments?
Well, I would just echo your welcome. I think especially we'd like to welcome the Oregon's newest state representative, Sarah Gelser, who's joined us here this morning. It's nice to have her here and interested, and for most of us, first time to meet her, and welcome, and great learning experience to be here.
Thank you.
With that, Mr. Co-Chair, I think we need to move forward with a motion to adopt the rules.
Yes. Before we do that, I will open a work session on adopting the task force rules and accept your motion to adopt those rules.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'd move that the draft rules for the House Interim Task Force on the Oregon Health Plan be adopted.
Thank you. Are there any questions? I think you all were sent copies of the rules, so you've had a chance to go over them. Do you have any questions? Are there any areas of concern? You will note that there are subcommittees may be appointed by the co-chairs in light of the fact that this is a very busy task that we have, and in light of the fact that for some of us, although I see a lot of folks here that are close to the building, but some of us it's a long jaunt over here, and in light of the fact that the leadership may get stingy with money, we might find it in the best interests of both the task force and the doing the work that we have to have some subcommittees formed as we go along to deal in depth with some of the issues that we will be looking at. So I would call your particular attention to the subcommittees and the fact that that the co-chairs have the ability to appoint those subcommittees, and I would expect that we will be doing so. So with that, are there any other comments? Are there any objections to the rule? Hearing none, so adopted. And at this particular juncture, it is truly my pleasure and privilege to once again be serving with Sandy as the staff person for this committee. We are very appreciative of her and her work for us, and we're also appreciative that we have Ms. Mullins as our assistant, committee staff person. And these two charming ladies will do their best to keep us on track and keep us from doing anything that will cause too many eyes to be raised. With that then, Sandy, I would ask if you have any comments or any areas that you'd like to discuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the task force. I'm very excited about working with all of you. Some of you are new faces. Some of you are old hats of working with me. So feel free to call myself or Annette at any time with any questions about the task force or anything else that might rise in your duties as a legislator for committees, I'm always here to help. So don't hesitate. I do have a member chart that I will be passing around that I'd like for you folks to update with more accurate information other than what we might have out there, that if you have a preference of where you want to be reached, et cetera, so that either Annette and I can get a hold of you, you know, easily. So thank you.
And also with that, I think you have calendars here, if I'm not mistaken. What's your agenda or plans for those?
Mr. Chair, members, at the point where we start talking about the task force work plan that I sent out to the members, I wasn't sure if you folks wanted to start looking at your calendars after the new year to start setting meeting dates. So I have little packed monthly calendars here that I don't know who has PDAs and manual calendars, that if we want to start highlighting dates for everybody's preparation, that's what these are. I will also pass those around to you for our discussion later on.
My understanding, Sandy, that we haven't been given, and maybe we have by now, a number of meetings that we are going to be able to have.
That is correct, Mr. Co-Chair. We, as you can tell from the work plan, we submitted a request for 7 meetings. I had a conversation with leadership last week. I did not get a sense that the task force would be approved for all 7 meetings. So we're waiting to see how what the final budget for the task force is actually approved for. But at that same time, I didn't think that it would be too much of a problem for the committee to look at least 3 meetings out, or like to March or April, and then we can always combine the agenda items as we get the final approval of that work plan that is in front of you.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I also had a discussion with leadership last week and reviewed the agenda. It's my feeling that we're probably as close to having approval for our meeting schedule as any committee would be. I think the importance, well, I'm saying that because the importance of our task force and what we're up to during the interim here, I actually met with a speaker to discuss that. I know there are some budgetary constraints on all the committees, but to keep the content and the work effort of this committee at the highest level, I think we're going to need the meetings we've outlined. And I really put a pitch in that we'd be allowed to have enough time to get that work done. So I felt pretty good when I came away from that in terms of being allowed to have the schedule that we set forth.
The direction I got from leadership, from the speaker, was such that we were supposed to find a way to do more with less. Which, if she really expects us to do that, and I think she may, probably means that we're going to have to use a considerable amount of time. I don't think there's any question in any of our minds that in a lot of places there is a need, as far as OMAP is concerned, to be able to provide more and perhaps better services. And there is no question that we live in a world where money is short, I'm sure, continue to be short. So our responsibility is certainly significant and difficult. And I do appreciate your conversations, Representative, with the leadership on that. Any other discussion items, opening comments here?
Are you still with us, Representative Dalto?
Yes, I am.
Thank you.
How about you, Representative? You've got a substantial background in this area, and I know have your own committee that you'll be working with in the human services area. Do you have any anything for us before we begin with the agency presentations this morning?
No, I'm fine, but Mr. Chairman, I am expecting you to solve the ills of our state Medicaid program in the next 7 meetings, so I'll be cheering you along.
Oh, there, very, very good. Thank you, Representative. That's We love these high expectations. As Grandpa said, better to shoot the moon and hit the woodpile than it is to shoot the woodpile and hit your foot. We'll certainly try to live up to that in any way. We will certainly be shooting for the moon on our agenda. With that, then, let's move right quickly into the informational meeting with the review of the Department of Human Services. And we have the director, Bruce Goldberg, here, I think, is to do the lead-off on this. And we'd like to welcome you, Bruce, to the committee. And yes, Sandy, thank you. We will open the informational meeting at this point.
Well, thank you for the record. Bruce Goldberg, Director of the Department of Human Services. Co-chairs Jensen and Hannah and members of the committee, really am thrilled to be here and here to pledge my assistance to all of you in terms of shooting the moon. That would be great. I think that I have the same expectations that hopefully we can we can move towards making a better system. I have a tremendous passion for human services, and I think it's an important issue that we all face in the state, and I look forward to working with you on it. What I hope to do this morning is be brief and do a couple of things. One, just introduce myself to you because I am new to the Department of Human Services, although I've worked with some of you before. Two, to provide a brief overview of the Department of Human Services, and although this is a committee on the Oregon Health Plan, this is all interrelated, and I don't want us to lose the thread of the fact that we operate in a system that is interrelated. So those are my two objectives. I'm now in my sixth week as director of the Department of Human Services. It's been great. I come at this, one, as I said, because I have a passion for human services and trying to make this a better system. My experience is having really approached this from a variety of perspectives. I'm a family physician, and I've taken care of many of the people that are on the Oregon Health Plan. And so I have a perspective of the importance of the Oregon Health Plan as well as the other programs from the Department of Human Services from the perspective of the clients that we serve. I've been a business partner with the state, run a number of organizations that have had contractual relationships with the state, and understand what it means to be in a, hopefully what is a successful and a collaborative business partner, because certainly we rely on a lot of people in the community, doctors, hospitals, managed care plans, and others to deliver our services. And I think thirdly, having spent the last few years in the Office of Health Policy, understand many of these issues from the policy side and what this means and the implications of what we do. And that's really what I hopefully bring is an experience in understanding these issues from a variety of perspectives and a willingness to make this a system that we can all be proud of, where the people who work at DHS are proud to be working for DHS and the people in the state are proud that we're working for them. I've brought with you an overview. I've brought for you an overview of the department, and at the highest level, because I know that there are some committee members that have not been as intimately involved in human services as others. We're really structured around, in essence, seven functions, and those are the administrative services, which provide the administrative support for the department, contracting and our information systems, and the administrative support for the department. We have the Division of Children, Adults, and Families, which is responsible for both our self-sufficiency programs, as TANF, as well as for child welfare and child protection. We have seniors and people with disabilities, a division that is devoted to our finance and policy, in essence our budgeting, and a health services group, which is made up of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, which is primarily what this committee will be dealing with, our Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, as well as our Public Health Division. And I bring that as an overview, but want to spend just a moment, in essence, providing a couple of examples of how this is all related in terms of the Oregon Health Plan. Certainly what we do or don't do in the Oregon Health Plan affects our child welfare system, our seniors and people with disabilities, our public health system. When we look at mental health, certainly mental health benefits in the Oregon Health Plan are a particularly telling example of how access to mental health care ripples through programs that are responsible for child welfare. Our ability to treat mental illness and substance abuse has an impact on the ability of our families to care for their children, have impacts throughout the criminal justice system and throughout our communities as a whole. Same thing for our seniors and people with disabilities. So when I think we look at the Oregon Health Plan and we look at DHS, you know, my vision is to, we have an organizational chart, and certainly every organization has to have the appropriate organizational accountabilities. But when you look at what we do and how we do it, we've got to be able to look at this as a sum of the parts and not part by part. When I look at some of the issues at a high level that I hope to be focusing on, there's several. You know, number one is transparency. I think that...
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Dr. Goldberger, while we're at the structure overview, the OMAP program specifically, mm-hmm. I don't know that you're prepared to talk about this, but...
Jim Edges.
Well, I mean, you know, we're looking at this. Lynn Reed is an interim. Jim Edge is acting. Gene Phillips is acting. Where are we in terms of permanency of leadership within that group? What, can you tell us where we're...
Co-Chairs Jensen and Hannah, I am actively recruiting for leadership within OMAP and have been having a number of conversations with individuals and hope to, in the not-too-distant future, be opening up a job announcement for that.
Okay. And that's just as far as you... I mean, there's nothing more to report there in terms of...
No, I don't... I don't have someone who I'm going to talk to about it in a week or two. You know, I've been trying to get to know the organization, and indeed that there are a couple of key positions in the organization that I'm going to be seeking to fill, and that's certainly one of them. We've got to have stable and effective leadership, and to be honest, I don't want to... I want that to happen quickly, but not so quickly that we don't get the right person in that role.
Okay. Thank you.
Co-Chair Jensen, thank you. Just a kind of a timeline, because I'm a real concrete, sequential person. Are you looking at filling that within 3 months, 6 months? What kind of a mental picture do you have about that?
Representative, comp members of the committee, I would like to have that filled in the next 2 months.
Okay, thank you.
I think that, having said that, what I would like is the best person.
Right.
And I would, that's my vision, but we'll see what we can do.
Thank you. That helps.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Dr. Goldberg, just a structural question under OMAP. Besides the OHP, what other programs fall under that?
I'm going to let Jim Edge take care. I think that's really it.
Okay.
Other questions? Go ahead. Please.
Great. Just want to spend a moment talking about some of the themes that I hope to be addressing at DHS. One is... As I was saying, transparency. We've got to have an organization that's fully transparent, that is also accountable and I think transparency is a big part of accountability, so that we can really provide the type of stewardship that we're entrusted with, and that stewardship is along a couple of lines. One, it's stewardship for the resources that we have, to be able to be accountable for the dollars that we get and how we spend them, but I think also stewardship for the outcomes as well. I think it gets back at the theme I heard of doing more with less. It's being able to provide the appropriate outcomes, and I think we need to stress the outcomes that we get for the resources that we receive. I also hope to have an organization that looks at how we integrate services, both within DHS as well as within the community. We've got to look at how we integrate our services with those available in the community, how we integrate with our community partners, how we break apart some of the programmatic silos that I think don't help us with our ability to efficiently deliver a product. And I think that's the vision that we want and that our clients want. I think that we need to look at how we organize services around the clients that we serve and not around program boxes on an administrative chart. We're facing a lot of challenges. I think that certainly a number of the challenges revolve around some of the demographics of our community, that we're seeing a population that is aging, and greater numbers of people in our state that are aging. That's going to have tremendous implications on the two committees that are meeting today, both the Oregon Health Plan as well as Seniors and People with Disability. The Oregon Health Plan doesn't just provide the medical services. We're also, and a large part of our expenditures are around long-term care. And so when we look at how we organize and deliver services in the future, we've got to be mindful of an aging demographic, of the fact that when we talk about the Oregon Health Plan, we're not just talking about doctor visits and hospital visits in a community. We're talking about a larger system that integrates long-term care. So we really have to look at how we integrate our programs and how we build our programs to function 10 years from now. I don't think that when we look at what we're doing, we can focus on building something for this next year or the year that follows. We've got to be building things for how we think they're going to be 10 years from now and be able to respond to that. And I think that we haven't done a good job of that in the past. And, an example of that is, for instance, our information systems. We're using a 25-year-old Medicaid information system, which has a tremendous amount of difficulty functioning in today's environment. We're upgrading that now. I think many of you know, and you'll hear about that as the committee moves on. But I bring that up as an example of being able to bring ourselves to not just the business and care delivery processes of today, but the processes of the future. And I think those are some of the challenges that we're facing on the Oregon Health Plan side. Just for one moment, I'd urge that we look at this as a system-wide issue. The Oregon Health Plan isn't an island, either within the Department of Human Services nor within the community as well, that many of the issues that are facing the Oregon Health Plan, which are issues about cost, quality, and access, are some of the same issues that is faced around health care in the community. We're seeing a number of challenges in our health care system as a whole, rising rates of uninsurance in the state, which has personal impacts to those individuals who go without health care, people who don't have access to health care and don't have health insurance are sicker and die sooner. But we also have economic impacts. About 10% of health care premiums paid by businesses go to caring for the uninsured. So these are all interrelated. We've got real system problems. We've had many. Those are certainly some of the challenges. We've been through a challenging time with the Oregon Health Plan, with many cuts, a lot of instability in the program. We've also seen some successes, and you know, some of those successes have been our community-based managed care plans, which have provided an infrastructure in our communities. We've certainly seen an ability to help keep costs within the Oregon Health Plan flatter than in the general health care community. We've, you know, focused on evidence-based care, and I think have been moving towards trying to pay for care that works and not pay for care that doesn't, to be able to get the right care to people at the right time. But there's no doubt that we face a lot of challenges. And the last comment I would just make, and before I turn things over to Jim Edge or entertain any questions, is, you know, I think that when we look at what we can do within the Oregon Health Plan, there's really three levers that we have and that I think we need to keep in mind as we move through looking at what we can do. You know, we can affect the eligibility, who gets on and those we serve. We have some limits in that in terms of a floor by the federal government, but we can then move up from there if there's a desire to do that. We can change benefits. We can determine what are the appropriate benefits, what are the ones that make the most sense for the state, for the population that we serve, what are the benefits that are going to focus on, I think, the kinds of prevention and early intervention that we'd all like to see and that I think have been a part of the Oregon Health Plan. And that the last thing that we can do is, the last lever we have is the payment lever. And I think, as many of us know, it's a lever that we have often pulled. We tend to pull it in sometimes a way that causes difficulties by decreasing payments, which then mean we don't pay equitably for services. We continue a cost shift onto others, and we impact the access to care in our communities. But those are the three, I think, tools that you have, and I guess that gets wrapped up in a package, which is the fourth piece about how we organize that. And
Representative Dalton.
Yeah, when it's appropriate, I had an observation and a question.
Yes?
I think it's a perfect time because I'm going to stop right there.
Okay. Quite a first month on the job, Dr. Goldberg, huh?
Representative Dalto, yes, it's been I've been learning a lot, and it's there have been a lot of challenges.
They say it only gets better, I think.
I hope so. Although they also say this is the honeymoon period, and that this is going to be the best of times. So we'll see.
Forebode the marriage. Anyway, Dr. Goldberg, I a question about terms that you employed to describe what you see as one of the solutions for improving outcomes in the human services area, and that is adding transparency and accountability to the functions of the agency. And these are words that are sort of used pretty frequently these days in a lot of different areas. And my question to you was first, do we have an operational definition as far as the department is concerned of transparency and accountability, and what what would those definitions be, and then do we have a mechanism to measure ourselves as to whether we're achieving transparency and accountability? I'll stop there, and then I'll ask another question.
Representative Dalto, members of the committee, great question. I can't tell you that I have an operational definition right now of transparency and accountability. I think that establishing one would be an important thing to do. I think that transparency and accountability, I think we know it when we see it, that operationally, to me, what transparency means is that the information that decision makers and policy makers in the state need is available to them when they need it and in a form that's helpful to them. That the same goes with information to our business partners, as well as to our clients, that we need to look at being able to provide people that there's an array of information that different people need. What policymakers need a different set of information than our clients need. And our clients need a different set of information than some of our program managers need. And I think that part of transparency is being able to have that information readily available. In terms of accountability, I think that accountability means that what we need to do is to be able to, A, account for the resources that we get, and that is being able to understand what dollars we get, where they come from, and how we spend them. But it goes one step further, which is to be accountable for the outcomes that we get. And I think that that's the piece that needs to drive some of this, is to be able to be accountable not just for what we spend, but what we get for that. What are the outcomes that we get? If our goal is to improve the health of the population, I think we need to be accountable and to demonstrate how we do that. And not just to count things, but to be able to look at some of the outcomes that we get for what we do. That to me is transparency and accountability, although maybe not the succinct two sentence definition that you were looking for.
No, I don't, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I don't know that I was looking for anything super brief, but I do have a sense of you know how you're going to approach those two issues. So I think that's helpful. Then my second question is, if I may, Mr. Chair. This question of forecasts. Now, I lost you for about 5 minutes right after you started speaking, Dr. Goldberg, so I'm not sure if you covered forecasts or not, but my question is, I think getting to the heart of, you know, what getting to the heart of the challenges the agency is having in these new budget shortfalls that are appearing, it sounds like they are forecasting issues and the challenges of having more people sign up for benefits than anticipated or modeled based on historical trends, creating a greater demand for healthcare services and consequently a higher cost to the system. So, you know, as the public, I guess with the context of the public commission on a legislature meeting and this discussion about annual sessions and all that kind of stuff, I wonder, is the department forecasting projection, making these forecast projections on a biennial basis to fit with the budget in terms of, you know, how many people are going to access service? And if so, is the department doing it two and a half years in advance when the governor starts his process for his recommended budget? And if that's the case, would we find some kind of benefit from shortening that time frame from which forecasts are made to some kind of annual basis or something like that? I mean, obviously, the department is doing a constantly reconciling and reporting to the emergency board regularly on on changes in caseloads, actual versus projections. But if you weren't projecting out so far, 2 years, for example, maybe the department would be able to be more effective in meeting the projections.
Representative Dalton, members of the committee, I agree with the point you were making there at the end. I think we can be very accurate in talking about what our caseload is going to be in January of 2006. And I can get a lot closer in predicting the caseload in January 2006. When I get to January in 2007, a year from now, my degree of accuracy is going to be diminished. There's going to be a greater confidence interval that's built around that. And when we get out to January 2008, even I'll have even less confidence in that. Much as I can do a better job of predicting the weather this afternoon than I can a week from now.
Well, I was going to ask you to prognosticate January 07. So will Dalto be reelected
for
the Super Bowl?
Well, you know, when we talk about baseball scores, and you and I both know the Yankees are going to win the World Series next time. But I think that there's a couple of issues. I think there'll be more information about forecasting later today. Judy Moore Peterson is going to walk people through the forecasting process. But I think that we do need to look at some different ways of how we build a budget. Because I think that it's not just around our ability to forecast caseloads, but it's also around our ability to land a healthcare budget in the Oregon Health Plan on a dime. And I'll give you an example. There isn't a single managed care organization, health plan in this state on the commercial side, who can predict exactly their medical expenses for a year. What they do is have reserves. And they have those reserves because they understand that a couple of additional heart transplants above and beyond what were anticipated in a year, or a couple of infants who end up in a neonatal intensive care unit, or the advent of a new vaccine which helps save people's lives, all these things change. And we can't land, they can't land a budget like that on a dime. And I don't think either can we. So we not only have a caseload issue, we have an expenditure issue, and then we also have what's happening on the eligibility side as well. And what's being done or not being done where people are signing up. So I think that there are a lot of challenges, and I think this gets at the transparency issue. What I'd like to move towards is, and you just saw it, we sent out our forecasts a month ago, well, 3 weeks ago, to the legislature. We normally haven't done that. I did that purposely because, one, I wanted, when we have information, we need to share it. I think that we need to talk about the implications of these things. I think that we need to move towards a way in which we work together to monitor that caseload every few months so that we don't get in a position of 8 months down the road, you're wondering why it is that suddenly you're hearing about a caseload change when we should be looking at that every month or two and looking at whether or not things are on a particular path or not on a path.
Dr. Goldberg, when you say we should be looking at these things every month or two, is that a suggestion that's not the case right now?
We are, as a department. I don't think that it moves out. I don't think that there have been those conversations that have moved beyond the department. And I think that, I think that we need to move to a way where we're better at sharing information and working together. And that's, I don't think it's been kept from anybody, but I think this is, we've got to establish the ways that we work together, what are some of the expectations, and it's about transparency and accountability.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Dr. Goldberg.
Thank you. Coach Johanna.
Thank you, Mr. Did I understand you to say that you think OHP has done a better job of controlling costs than the private sector? I mean, I thought I heard you say part of that. And I mean, the room's full of private sector providers here. And there's two or three or maybe many more ways that you might be doing that better than the private sector. But I mean, you maybe can just manage your costs better. Or maybe you can eliminate benefits to recipients, or you can reduce payments to providers. In your mind, when you say we're doing a better job than the private sector, share with us how you think you're doing that better than the private sector.
If you look at the cost trends in our Medicaid managed care plans, they've held them at a less steep rate of growth. And I think that's been around some of the risk-sharing arrangements that we've put together with them. I think it's about their abilities to be locally based in communities working with some of those populations. And I think it's been about the collaborative nature of how we're all trying to work towards this. But I can, you know, we can bring in and show you what the actuaries have told us. And it's created an interesting situation where on one hand, the capitation rates within the managed care plans aren't increasing. And that's on one hand a good thing for the state. On the other hand, the question is, what's the reward and incentive to keep doing that?
Follow up, Mr. Co-Chair. I appreciate your comments that way, and I think in my mind one of the key issues with this committee, and in my limited experience, though some with healthcare as a legislator, many times what we have is a breakdown of the communication between the providers, those folks out there providing the care, the recipients, the folks we're trying to serve, and our job, I think, is to provide as much care as possible for the cost, and the agency that's providing that. So I would hope during this time that in your definition of transparency, part of that will be that we will put those groups together and we will say, if you feel like you can say, I think we're doing this a little better than the private side, we need to get these folks in the room included in smaller conversations, if that's our subcommittee assignments or whatnot, and say, what's Dr. Goldberg's group doing that we can learn from? And what are these providers who we get letters and communication from that would say, we're making suggestions, we're saying, here's how we think we could do it better, and that's falling on deaf ears? Somehow we've got to merge those pieces together so that everybody feels like they've got their idea on the table, and when you say we're doing it better, you get a chance to explain yourself, and they understand how that is. And if they agree or disagree, they have an opportunity to voice that and put forth their suggestion for what might make it better, what we can do to either hold costs or drive costs down, and that we can honestly get more people served.
Representative Hanna, I agree, and I think the issue here is, you know, first off, better doesn't mean best. And that there are a lot of people that do a lot of things well, and there's also a lot of room for improvement. And I think that we need to all figure out, we have to be strategic, first off, about what are the things we tackle to get the benefits that we're looking for, and I think we need to look for best practices throughout. Mm-hmm. I also think you hit on one of the challenges in healthcare, which is, and it gets back to some of the other themes about, you know, accountability and outcomes. Everybody, whether it's consumers who want unfettered access to healthcare, providers who want to be able to provide whatever it is they want, a state that looks at how it sets its limits, a question of what are the outcomes that you get for those expenditures, and looking at the fact that not all healthcare is created equal. There are some things that have better outcomes than others, and I think we have to... Those are real challenges. I think you're very aware of those, and I'm not trying to oversell anything about the Oregon Health Plan. Please don't get me wrong. I was alluding to. I think we've got a lot of challenges. We've also had some successes that I think we can't we can't dismiss. But I don't think do we have all the answers.
No, please
don't take what I said as in any way insinuating that.
As a follow-up, I don't at all. I found that it's an opportune time to say part of the role of this group is to get those folks together and get the best input from each and see if we can't merge that together. to improve the outcome, and is to say it gets better, is it the you know, Cadillac level? I don't know that we're going to get to Cadillac level, but it sure ought to be a long run and Chevy program. You ought to be able to get health care for a reasonable cost for a long time period, and that's, I think, the direction.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you, Representative Buckley.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Actually, Representative Hanna, I look more at the Toyota Prius model.
Okay. Yeah.
The hybrid. Dr. Goldberg, I just want to make a couple comments and ask a question. First of all, I really appreciate your approach to this, particularly in terms of looking at the outcomes as part of accountability and looking at the services from the client's point of view. I can't emphasize that enough. The feedback we get from people in our districts is, well, you know, this part's great, but why is it happening this way, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's extremely important. The question I have, though, in terms of the vision, the 10-year vision, whose responsibility do you see creating the 10-year vision for the Oregon Health Plan? Is that our responsibility on this task force? Is it your responsibility as director of the agency? Or is it the whose responsibility is to actually make the first step towards defining what the Oregon Health Plan will be 10 years from now?
Well, Representative Buckley, members of the committee, I think we all have a responsibility for that. I hope that we'll take some of the lead in doing that. But as we do that, I think that there's got to be, we're not going to be the vanguard, and that if we've learned anything, I think, in Oregon in the last decade or two, it's the fact that it's the ability of everyone to have input into that vision and to help shape that vision and to have some ownership and buy into that. And If I came forward and said, I've got a vision, and you all laughed at me, my vision wouldn't go very far. Mm-hmm. And so if what you're asking for is, are we going to provide some of that leadership, I certainly hope so.
Very good. Thank you.
Other questions? Seeing no other questions, I do have a few curiosity, I guess, point. What portion of the OMAP services budget or services is directly related to the other health services that are in your operational diagram here, mental health and public health? Seems to me, at least in relationship to the legislation that passed in the last legislature about health, mental health services, that there must be some direct financial tie to OMAP on that. Could you agree with that?
Representative Jensen, of course. Let's take mental health, for example. I mean, these are all related. And what we fund or don't fund in the health plan can get funded or not funded some other place. Mental health care is an example. We provide mental health care, and we've always had parity in terms of mental health care in the Oregon Health Plan. So if someone is on the Oregon Health Plan right now, they get a complete mental health care benefit with mental health treatment as well as payment for the mental health drugs that they need. We have had periods of time when we haven't paid for that, when mental health care wasn't paid for on the Oregon Health Plan. When that happens, those people still need mental health care, and they've gotten it in the community-based programs. What counties provide in communities to meet the mental health care needs of their citizens. So what we provide meets the needs of the people on the Oregon Health Plan. Likewise, in terms of prevention, people on the Oregon Health Plan get mammograms, women get mammograms, pap smears, children get immunizations who are on the Oregon Health Plan. children who have no health insurance and or women who have no health insurance and aren't on the Oregon Health Plan may get those services, women's health care services, pap smears, immunizations through local health departments. Much of that support comes from both local government as well as from state government. So these are related in that regard. I think that when it comes to health care, you know, health care isn't discretionary. When you know, if a child needs an immunization, they need an immunization. You know, if a woman needs a mammogram, or if someone gets sick, they need care. You know, the issue is where it is we fund that. So there's a dynamic across the community in what happens. And some of that's picked up by local government, and some is picked up by the local providers in the community. Hospitals who see people who are uninsured, doctors who see people who are uninsured. Does that get at what you were looking for?
Well, yes, I think as an introduction to this, but it strikes me that if we're going to come close to accomplishing our agenda for OMAP, that these other two areas especially need to be part of that consideration.
Yes.
To ignore them is to ignore a substantial portion of the caseload, the dollars, or however way we choose to measure it, you know, from the formula. And just as a point of some interest, I think you said, and I may be wrong on the percentage here, but I think you said that the cost of business is 10% for the uninsured in America. I understand where that cost, I think, comes from as far as business. That somehow, to me, though, the easier or the more the real figure would be the cost of the uninsured to the whole rather than just to just the business, because while it may cost business an extra 10%, that also means that my insurance premium goes up by that, which is 10%, or something that might come to me in other forms. You know, so do you have any other figures other than, and I'm not asking for those right now, but I'm just it's a curious sort of thing. Just other than just the cost of business.
Representative Jensen, I don't have any other figures, but that 10% figure actually is an analysis done nationally, and there's state-by-state analysis. And the 10% is 10% of a commercial health insurance premium. So that's 10% of the premium that you would pay as an individual if you went to an insurance agent and bought your own health care plan. It's also 10% of a business that is providing health care for its workers. So that 10% is across the community.
That's the answer to
right.
The question.
And I can actually give you, I will provide to Sandy the study as well as the dollars that are associated with that. But I think the other point embedded in what you were saying is that there are many other costs which that doesn't account for that ripple through, whether that's the costs that incur when people who need mental health care don't get it and end up, for instance, in the criminal justice system, that, you know, there are costs to care that happens because it's delayed and happens at a more expensive time. This doesn't account for any of those kinds of issues.
I would appreciate that information.
Yeah.
I think it would be helpful for us to keep that in mind as we proceed through. And just one concluding thing here, I think You indicated that you thought that the department was, or would be at least under your directorship, doing an ongoing assessments as times, conditions, and circumstances changed, but you questioned whether others do, if I'm recalling correctly. And the question I had, are you suggesting that the legislature should do this? And if so, be careful what you ask for. That's an editorial comment.
No, my editorial comment back is we're all in this together.
I know.
And I hope to... I think both of our comments are taken in the spirit with which I think we both wanted them to be met. Let's stop there. you taught me that maybe less is more.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dr. Silver. We appreciate you being here. I'm sure we'll talk a number of times through the course of the next few months.
I hope so.
Great.
Thank you, Bruce.
Great.
And, good morning, co-chairs and members of the task force. My name is Jim Edge. I'm the Deputy Administrator of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, or OMAP is the acronym for us. Sandy reminded me this morning to try to keep the acronyms down a little bit and talk them rather than spout the acronyms. So I will try to do that.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Jim, I will appreciate that if you do. However, part of the committee's responsibility, I think, as we deal with this topic, is to become familiar with the acronyms. So while we would appreciate your telling us always maybe what they are, we need to know the acronym and become familiar with them, too. So don't hesitate to use them. And if we don't understand, we can always stop you. And
thank you, Representative Jensen. I will do both. I will state the acronym and the words that it represents, and that way we can learn. In fact, that's really what my presentation is all about this morning, is to do a high-level overview of the Oregon Health Plan, some history of the Oregon Health Plan, so that we can all be brought up to speed on what the Oregon Health Plan is about. And a few of you probably know some of this already, and I apologize if there's a little bit of repetition of what you might already know, but what I wanted to try to do is bring everyone up to speed with some history and background of what the Oregon Health Plan is all about and how we got to the place we are today. And then at the end of my presentation, I will hand it over to Judy Moore Peterson, our caseload forecasting manager, who will spend some time talking about caseload forecasting, which really is the topic we want to get to for this meeting this morning. So just to start with, I will say that the Oregon Health Plan is Oregon's version of Medicaid. The Oregon Health Plan came out of a planning process in the legislature in the late 1980s and early 1990s, and some of the folks in this room probably know that what happened in those years better than I do. But there was a health planning process in the legislature that developed a concept of doing a better job of providing Medicare to Oregonians, Medicaid to Oregonians, excuse me. Medicaid is a jointly operated program by the state and the federal government, and anything we do has to have the approval of the federal government. So there were several years of negotiation back and forth with the federal government when the concept of Oregon doing something other than traditional Medicaid was developed. Just to mention what some of the original principles of the Oregon Health Plan were, and these principles really continue until today, but principles developed during that time was that there would be a health care coverage for most, if not all, low-income Oregonians, uninsured Oregonians, a basic benefit package of effective services for the people served by the Oregon Health Plan. Broad participation by most, if not all, providers in Oregon. A rational process for decision-making about what care would be provided to clients served by the Oregon Health Plan. And gaining control of costs in the Oregon Health Plan. Those were original principles, which are good principles even today. And we haven't necessarily fully succeeded in all of these areas, but they remain goals. As that planning process went forward, there were some unique features that were developed for Oregon's version of Medicaid, what became the Oregon Health Plan. And the first one was that Medicaid would be available to all individuals below the federal poverty level, all individuals in poverty in Oregon. That's not the case in states who run a traditional Medicaid program. Those programs generally are targeted towards what we speak of as categories or categories of eligibility, specific categorical eligibility. And Oregon wanted to provide services to all individuals in poverty, whether they met those specific categorical requirements or not. And then there was our prioritized list of health services, which became a basic component of the Oregon Health Plan, and that continues to today. That list was a way of rationally making decisions about rationing health care in an evidence-based way. And the prioritized list was also envisioned as a way to live within available revenue by moving the line on the prioritized list. We haven't always been successful in getting the federal government, our partner, to agree with those line movements we want to make, but that remains a principle and a way we are trying to operate that prioritized list. And then another unique feature of the Oregon Health Plan at that time and that continues till today is to provide as much care as possible through managed care. And we are continuing to make that an emphasis area. Just to kind of go through a brief history of changes, major changes in the Oregon Health Plan. The Oregon Health Plan began in February of 1994. So it's just a little over 10 years old. It began as what's called a demonstration project, which means the state of Oregon was demonstrating to the federal government that we have a better way of operating a Medicaid program. And they allowed us some waivers of some federal requirements in order to do that demonstration, in order to implement some of these things like the prioritized list of health services. And so we continue to operate a demonstration project called the Oregon Health Plan, which is Oregon's version of Medicaid. Skipping ahead to the next substantial major change in the Oregon Health Plan, coming out of the 2001 legislative session, there was a bill that restructured the Oregon Health Plan. And that was House Bill 2519. And out of that bill, we got direction to restructure the Oregon Health Plan to implement a more basic level of health services for those individuals who were added to the Oregon Health Plan and would not have been eligible in a traditional Medicaid program, and a little more comprehensive level of services, package of services, for the people in the program who were in the traditional categories of service. So we developed an OHP standard program, which was our expansion population, or our new eligibles in the Oregon Health Plan, with a more basic level of services and what we call the OHP plus population, who continue to get the level of the benefit package that they had been getting up until that time. There was a significant negotiation that took place with the federal government, significant public input process, And finally, we did get approval from the federal government to implement the provisions of that legislative bill. And it began in November of 2002, actually in the FEOP program, which is the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, which is a program in Oregon that provides assistance to individuals and families who are very low income to pay their insurance premiums. It's a private sector program operated by the state government. And with that new waiver, we were able to begin getting federal matching funds on the expenditures in the FEOP program. And that was the first time that we had begun to get federal matching funds for that program. And that was followed soon after in February of 2003 with the actual implementation of what we call OHP2 in the DHS side, the public side of the Oregon Health Plan. And the OHP standard with a more limited benefit package and the OHP Plus with a little more comprehensive benefit package were implemented. Along with the more basic level of service for the OHP standard population went some cost sharing, and we implemented some monthly premiums that were a little higher than had been in place previous to that point, and some copayments that were higher than had been in place prior to that point for this expansion population, for the OHP standard population. So that was the implementation of what we now look back on and call the beginning of OHP2, or the Oregon Health Plan 2. Then in March of 2003, just a month...
No change in Plus?
There was no change to the benefit package in Plus, and there was no premium required for the individuals in Plus, and the these higher copayments were not imposed on the clients in Plus. This was also during the middle of a legislative session, and so a month after that, in March of 2003, there was a legislative decision based on the fact that Oregon was in a recession and there was limited funding available and concern about expenditures in the Oregon Health Plan, and there was some benefit changes made to the OHP standard program. And the primary benefit change was that outpatient mental health and chemical dependency were removed from the OHP standard population. Also, prescription drugs were removed from that for a period of 2 weeks and then reinstated when funding was found to reinstate prescription drugs to the benefit package. Then coming out of that legislative session, coming out of the 2003 legislative session, there was a bill that was passed, House Bill 2511, to make some additional changes in the Oregon Health Plan. And the Department of Human Services was instructed to begin negotiating again with the federal government to make those changes. Again, it takes a long time to negotiate changes to the demonstration project with the federal government. So it was a good 8 or 9 months before we were able to negotiate and get approval and make those changes. During that period of time, just for your information, I'll let you know too that as a result of a court case, we had to eliminate the copayments on the OHP standard program. There was a lawsuit brought against the department, and the lawsuit directed the department to eliminate copayments for standard clients. The small copayments actually continue for the OHP Plus clients, but in standard they have been eliminated as a result of that lawsuit. Then moving ahead to implementing what came out of that legislative session and what came out of legislative decisions, there was, during that period of time, a decision made at an emergency board meeting that the Oregon Health Plan standard was no longer fundable with the general fund revenue that was available, and the general fund revenue was eliminated from OHP standard. And we were given the direction that if OHP standard was to continue, it would have to continue with a set of provider taxes and the premiums that are collected from those clients. There had been a bill passed in the previous legislative session that allowed us to implement provider taxes on hospitals in Oregon and on managed care organizations, Medicaid managed care organizations. And we were in the process of moving ahead with those. And with this decision by the emergency board, it became clear that that was going to be the only funding source for OHP standard, and a decision was made to move forward with OHP standard as a funding source. The funding available through those sources, through hospital provider taxes, Medicaid managed care provider taxes, the premiums that are collected from clients, and then the federal matching funds that are given to Oregon as the federal portion of it, was not enough to continue to provide services to the people that were in the program at that time. There was something in the neighborhood of 54,000 people in OHP standard at the time, and it was calculated that the revenue that would be available was enough to provide care for about 24,000 people. So in July of 2004, OHP standard was closed to new enrollment, to new people coming into the program. And we started a process of, through attrition, of reducing the number of clients to a sustainable number, which is somewhere in the neighborhood of 24,000 people. We are still operating with that program closed, and we are nearing the point where we have about 24,000 people. Not quite there yet, but we're very near that point. Then in August,
make this
yes
distinction on which of the 54 get to be part of the 24.
Representative Jensen, the way that process has been developed and implemented is that people who continue to stay on the program and pay their monthly premiums and continue their enrollment will continue to be in standard. But the people who drop off of the program for various reasons, which could be not paying their monthly premiums, it could be the fact that they've moved out of state, it could be the fact that their income has gone up, they've gotten employment and their income has gone high enough that they no longer need this program, a variety of reasons. Everyone who drops off of the program for any reason whatsoever is what allows the program to gradually attrition down.
So it's a kind of drop it, you lose it.
That's right.
Yeah. Thank you, Co-Chair Jensen. I recently, within the last couple of months, heard a presentation by somebody about children that are eligible for the Oregon Health Plan, and that not many people know that children can sign up, and I'm asking a clarification to see if this is accurate information, that children can sign up separate from their parents, and the figure was given at this public presentation that there's 22,000 children in Marion County alone that would be eligible. I just thought that was an unbelievable amount of. There's huge numbers.
Yes, Representative Kopp and members of the committee. Children are in the OHP Plus benefit package. They're not okay. In the limited benefit package we're talking mm-hmm. about. I've been talking about for the last few minutes. There are children in the Oregon Health Plan, and there are children in a program called CHIP, which is the Children's Health Insurance Program.
Okay.
The children in the Oregon Health Plan are basically those children up to 133% of the federal poverty level for children under six, and then up to age 18, it's 100% of the federal poverty level. But then there's another program that was begun by the federal government in the late 1990s that was called the CHIP program, the Children's Health Insurance Program, which allowed states who chose to, this is an optional program, but allowed states who chose to cover additional children. Oregon has a CHIP program, and Oregon provides services to CHIP children through that program up to 185% of the federal poverty level. And yes, we're aware as we look at the uninsurance numbers that there are children out there who do not have insurance who would probably fall within the income ranges to qualify for the state's CHIP program or the state's Medicaid program. And it would be in our best interest to get those children signed up for that care. And
Right. There
are efforts underway to encourage that. There's also the opportunity for some children to come in through the FEOP program. If their parents buy private insurance or have insurance through their employer. And there's an outreach effort underway on the FEOP side to try to get more children enrolled. But there are many children in Oregon who mm-hmm. could be on the Oregon Health Plan in either the regular Oregon Health Plan or the CHIP mm-hmm. program or in FEOP who are uninsured today. And we would like to be able to reach out to those. Although we have to remember that as we reach out to them, there is a budget impact, and there's a cost to the more outreach effort we do, the more of those children that come into the program, there's a corresponding budgetary impact.
Thank you for the clarification.
Sure. I'll move through some of the rest of this fairly quickly. I know we want to get Judy Moore Peterson up here to talk about caseload forecasting. Okay, she's going to come up and start putting her computer presentation together while I finish talking. The current situation in the Oregon Health Plan is that OHP Standard continues to operate but is closed to new enrollees, that OHP Plus continues to operate and is open to new clients who would choose to enroll, that we continue to provide as much care as possible through managed care, and we're currently at about 75%. We serve about 75% of our clients through managed care and about 25% through fee-for-service programs. We actually have a goal of reaching 80% of our clients through managed care. We have currently three waivers pending with the federal government as a result of this last legislative session. And as always, the federal government is slow to respond and approve those waivers, but one of those is a waiver that will change the premium structure for individuals in the OHP Standard program and actually eliminate premiums for individuals who have below 10% of the federal poverty level as income. And that's about 40% of that population, which is either at zero income or below 10%. That's a waiver request that's currently with the federal government. There's another one with the federal government that came as a budget note in the FEOP funding bill that set aside a special purpose appropriation and directed us to approach the federal government and see if the legislature, if the legislative e-board could have flexibility in directing that special purpose appropriation either to FEOP or to DHS to fund more care through the Children's Health Insurance Program and have it count towards the federally required maintenance of effort that we have on the FEOP program. And that was discussed in the last e-board, and we had not received a federal answer on that yet. And some of that money was then appropriated to FEOP, and there's a small amount left. And we're hoping to get an answer from the federal government before the next e-board. The third waiver request that we have before the federal government. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS is another acronym we use a lot, is a benefit change waiver request. And that waiver request would have us implement a more limited dental benefit package on the OHP Plus clients, a limit on over-the-counter drugs, prescription drugs for OHP Plus clients, a limit on the number of hospital days that would be paid for, and would eliminate vision services for adults for OHP Plus. Those were all in Hospital 3108, and were part of living within the budget that was available for the Oregon Health Plan. And we have not received an answer from the federal government. So we are currently operating with that program in place, currently waiting for additional answers from the federal government, and trying to keep the program within budget. I'll just move briefly to talk about some of the challenges we face today as we operate a Medicaid program. One of them is inflation rates. Medical inflation rates have continued over many years to be higher than regular inflation rates in the economy. We have an increasing number of uninsured in Oregon, and in fact in all states in the nation. That's a nationwide trend, that there's increasing uninsurance for a variety of reasons. We have an aging population. Those of us who are baby boomers are moving through the population and getting to the point where we're soon going to be seniors and going to need more health care. And all states are dealing with this issue of more seniors in the population, and the baby boomers will create a drain on medical costs. Increasing costs of chronic diseases, and that's partly related to age, it's partly related to lifestyles. Diabetes is an example of a chronic disease that is increasing in almost epidemic proportions. And then we have issues with the federal government and the fact that the federal government has put some roadblocks in the way of Oregon being able to do all the things it would like to do. One of them is that they've never been very responsive to our requests to move the line on our prioritized list of health services, so that although that list we think probably succeeds in cost savings to us of about 10% if over not having that list in place, we don't have it as a tool to move the line for revenue changes, because the federal government has not been willing to allow us to make those changes. We also have the federal government going through what they call a budget reconciliation process, which just means that the federal government is worried about its budget too. And although they can deficit spend, they're very concerned about programs like Medicaid and Medicare and Social Security, and they're in the planning stages of putting some limits on those things. And the one that concerns us most at this point is a limit that they're discussing placing on states who have Medicaid managed care taxes in place. And if they were to implement that, it would remove the majority of the funding that currently funds our OHP standard population. So we are concerned about the fact that the federal government is trying to save money, in addition to the fact that the state government has a limited amount of funding available. The federal government has a goal of cutting $10 billion out of the Medicaid program nationwide over the next 5 years. And there has been a version passed in the Senate and a version passed in the House of a budget bill that would make those kinds of reductions, but the conference committee that would resolve the differences between the two has not yet met, so we're waiting to see what happens in that process. Just moving quickly then to a quick look at the organizational structure of the Oregon Health Plan. The Office of Medical Assistance Programs that I work for, OMAP, does the administrative operations, the primary administrative operations of the Oregon Health Plan. But the eligibility for the Oregon Health Plan, the various ways that people come onto the Oregon Health Plan, occurs in a variety of ways, primarily through our Children, Adults, and Families cluster. That acronym for that is CAF, C-A-F, and through our Seniors and Peoples with Disability. The Children, Adults, and Families has a central processing center that they operate here in Salem, out in North Salem, where they receive mailed-in applications for Medicaid and whatever other programs individuals are applying for. And they receive and make eligibility determinations and make people eligible for the Oregon Health Plan. CAF also has a structure of field offices throughout the state where caseworkers in the field make eligibility determinations and put people on the Oregon Health Plan. Our Seniors and Peoples with Disabilities cluster also has a field structure. And they have caseworkers who are making determinations about eligibility based on primarily on disability and age, and they make eligibility determinations that bring people onto the Oregon Health Plan. So through all of those different mechanisms, eligibility is determined. People are brought onto the Oregon Health Plan, and it all contributes to a caseload for the Oregon Health Plan. And that's my key word, caseload, to hand it over to Judy, unless you have some questions about what I've said.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Ed, just very quickly, can you tell me what the premium payments are currently for OHP standard?
Yes, OHP standard premiums range from $6 to $20 a month, depending on income. It's a graduated scale. Okay. And currently, $6 is what the minimum level that anyone can pay, and people who make up near 100% of the federal poverty level are paying the $20 per month premiums. As a result of the bill that was passed in the last legislative session, we would eliminate that $6 premium for the 0 to 10% of federal poverty individuals.
Thank you.
Yes. Representative.
Did I understand correctly that there's a copay in the PLUS program but not in the standard program?
Representative Gelser, yes, that's true. That's a it's an odd discrepancy that exists as a result of a court settlement. There are small copayments. The federal government allows states to implement what they call nominal copayments in the OHP plus population for individuals who would be eligible in any state. And we have those payments in place, and they're no more than $3 is the copayment on the OHP plus. When the court case was brought and the judge made a determination that eliminated copayments, what he eliminated was the higher copayments on the OHP standard population, which ranged from $5 for an office visit to $20 for an emergency room visit to a high of $200 for a hospitalization. And those copayments, he ruled he could not find federal statutes which gave the Secretary of Health and Human Services and the federal government permission to allow us to impose those. So he ruled that we must eliminate those. But we still have copayments on people in the OHP Plus, which is odd because people in OHP Plus generally are thought of as being more needy than people in OHP Standard. But that's the way the court settlement caused it to work out.
Thank you.
Put your hand up.
Thank you. It might not be today that you can provide this information, but in order for this committee to build on its base of knowledge about the, you know, sort of the 10,000-foot overview, I'm wondering, could you provide to Sandy and the rest of us some budgetary information, including the 0507 budget for the Oregon Health Plan piece, and maybe give us some information that would break down items like what percentage of OHP is provided through managed care versus through emergency care or other care modems, and then what percentage of OHP revenue is the premium? As Representative Buckley asked, you know, these premiums that are being paid, what percentage of that revenue is premium, and what percent of the revenue copay is, so that we can see the level of participation of those receiving care as it relates to the total revenue, and that everybody gets a feel for the size of universe we're dealing with in terms of the OHP budget. I think we're going to need some of that information to put everybody in a better place to understand the size of vehicle we're dealing with here.
Sure. Representative Hanna, we would be happy to do that, and we will prepare that for you.
One question before you leave. Why is you said that diabetes is increasing at that, I think your word, an epidemic rate. What are the reasons for that?
Representative Jensen and members of the committee, we probably need the folks from public health here to talk about epidemiology, but diabetes is related to not only genetics, but it's related to lifestyle, and it's related to obesity, and it's related to some things that, and it's related to age also. Diabetes occurs more in older ages, and all of those things seem to be contributing to a growth in diabetes, and among people who deal with epidemiology and among people who are dealing with chronic diseases, there is a very high concern that diseases such as diabetes are increasing so dramatically. It's certainly related in large part to the obesity epidemic in our nation, but there are other components to it too.
Thank you. I appreciate the if I want to other answer on that. There's another more probably appropriate place to go. I was going to say logical, and that is to imply that you don't know, and I would certainly never imply that. But as someone who fits all three of the, I guess even in fact all four of the categories that you included, genetics, age, and weight. I am toying with the proposal to increase or to attempt to increase the premiums on for people who do not manage the health care or manage their life accordingly. And I mentioned that I fit all of the categories, so I appreciate that while I'm not on the Oregon Health Plan, that I would be advocating for the same thing on non-Oregon Health Plan. And I don't know that the members of the committee, that's just a question that's been running around in my mind, and I know there are umpteen groups that will jump up immediately in protest on that. However, colleagues, we do have to get a handle on some of these issues, and we can't expect the government or others to pay forever for the sins of our transgressions, in life. And having at this point assured myself, I'm of a number of emails in the coming weeks, I'll be quiet before I increase the number.
Representative Jensen, I hear what you're saying. It's something that's been talked about by many people. I think what you're talking about in general is incentives for making healthy choices. And that is something that that has been looked at, not just in Oregon, but in other states, and something that we could look at more. There are some federal issues that would have to be hurdles, I might say, that would have to be jumped to go down that route. But I think it's worth looking at. And we would also have to look at the fact that many of the people on the Oregon Health Plan have certain disabilities, physical and mental, that might interfere with some of their ability to do some of that. But in general, I agree with your concept that we need incentives to make healthy choices.
Jim, I think age is showing through again, but I prefer to think of it as penalties for not.
Thank you, Scott Chair. Jim, as I was talking about controversial issues in the history of the Oregon Health Plan, can you touch briefly on the attempt to have employer mandate in terms of funding for the Oregon Health Plan?
Very briefly, that was prior to my time in state government and prior to my time working in OMAP, but one of the original concepts of the Oregon Health Plan was to have an employer mandate. And one of the original concepts was to reach something close to universal insurance or universal coverage in Oregon through a combination of public sector coverage, which would be the Oregon Health Plan, private sector coverage, which would be individual insurance, and an employer mandate, which would mandate insurance be covered through all employers. That third leg of the stool, the employer mandate, was never implemented, and so that piece of it does not exist today. Although, to a certain extent, the FEOP program plays some of that role in that they offer an insurance supplement for low-income employed individuals that allows some of those folks to be able to afford their insurance.
Thank you.
We're going to stand at ease for about 3 minutes to give everybody a chance to stretch and whatever. Three, make it five, no more. Back in session, Sandy has an announcement that she wants to make before we proceed.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. For the members, I emailed you the link to these reports. In doing a quick scan, I noticed that the members don't have hard copies of the dais. Is that accurate?
That's accurate.
Okay. So the audience that we retrieved from you, this is all available on the web. So you can go to the forecast and policy section of DHS's webpage, and there's a link there that you guys can get all of these reports. There's one out there for CAP, seniors and people with disability, medical assistance, and I think there might be one more. So members, I will pass this on to you, and then that information also is available to you for the web.
Thank you so much.
For future access. And I hope. Thank you.
Thanks. Oh, take care.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Okay. And we're now ready to go.
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Chair.
And Judy Mark Peterson. Please, Judy.
For the record, thank you very much for inviting me here today. And for the record, my name is Judy Moore Peterson, and I am the administrator for the client caseload forecasting team, which is part of finance and policy analysis in the Department of Human Services. And I was asked to provide an overview of our forecasting process, and then before I go diving into the details of the actual Oregon Health Plan, fall 2005 forecast. Hopefully, I do have some slides, and so we are ready to go. Yes. Anna, we're ready to go. this works, then it will come up there. And if it doesn't work, you should have that handout. What I'm going to be doing today is an overview of the DHS client forecasting processes. I'm going to go over also pretty high level the methods and the processes that we use, as well as then the final aspect of what I'm going to cover is the actual forecast for the Oregon Health Plan. Okay. I'll just keep going. The forecasting as a unit in the Department of Human Services is really at its infancy. It was initiated in mid-2004, so in the middle of the last biennium, and the unit was established to ensure that it was an independent process, and that standardized forecasting tools were to be used, including a statistical model or modeling tools that would be used. Right now, the process involves review and oversight by outside forecasting experts outside of the Department of Human Services, and that the process will be continually evaluated and modified over time as we keep going through this process. Hopefully the process itself will mature and will improve over time. For your handouts, that's probably too small. We're probably going to need to see the slide up there. This is the actual overall organizational structure. On the far left-hand column is the actual unit or the team that is engaged in the forecasting. So I'm the manager of that. And then there's three forecasters, and they each take a different part of the organization, a different cluster. So Kevin Hamlet-Duprat is in Children, Adults, and Families. Kush Shrestha is in Seniors, People with Disabilities. And Stephen Wilhite works on health services, of which the Oregon Health Plan is a part. We also have several research analysts who do a lot of the research on national and state trends, as well as trends that may be occurring within the department. We meet on a regular basis with program steering committees. These program steering committees are made up of program experts, for example, on the Oregon Health Plan, as well as with the field office staff, the budget people, as well as individuals from the Legislative Fiscal Office and from budget management staff as well. We'll get to exactly what they do in a bit later. The part of the external review comes in two different groups. One is a contracted technical review team, and they're part of a organization called Looking Glass Analytics, and that's on the far right-hand side. And they have experts in forecasting from various parts of the country. Their primary focus has been in Washington State, and they've brought that expertise to work with us. There's also a peer review group. The peer review group is made up of various forecasters and experts in the state, primarily in the state of Oregon. For example, we have the state economist, the state demographer, the state employment economist, also all on that committee, providing oversight and review of the methods, as well as the state trends or national trends that might impact the forecast.
And members of the task force, those are also in larger print as appendices in the hard report.
Thank you. This is a little bit on the three forecasters. Is that we wanted to bring some expertise both in kind of real-world forecasting as well as an educational experience, and this is just a summary of what some of that experience is. They've all had graduate-level education, either in population studies, in political science. All of them have it in statistics, so this is kind of a demonstration of that. They also have professional experience in forecasting, both within the state, working with populations that may be similar to the social services area of the Department of Human Services, as well as within the private industry. So they come with a wealth of experience. The various programs that have been forecast within the last year, because if you recall, it's only since mid-2004, are the Children, Adults, and Families, and this is a high-level overview of those particular programs, so within self-sufficiency, within child welfare, and also within vocational rehabilitation. Within the health services, it's forecast on medical assistance programs, which we'll go into greater depth at a later point. And that's broken up into OHP Standard, OHP Plus, and then other medical assistance programs. We also forecast mental health and addiction services. That has undergone some major revisions in this past year. So we've been trying to work very closely with the program people to be able to forecast those groups. We've also forecast within the seniors and people with disabilities several parts of the long-term care area. We do not forecast all DHS programs. In part, that's because it's a major task to take on all of those programs. So the programs that have kind of the largest impact, the largest populations, were the ones that were taken on by the centralized unit. This is an example of some of those things that are not being forecast at this time by our unit, and that's the development of disabilities, some of the long-term care services, and most of the public health programs are not forecast by our unit at this time. Something on a little background on forecasting methods. I'm sure that this isn't a surprise, but forecasting is really a combination of art and science, and it really is a balance between the two. There are multiple methods in both the art and science of forecasting. There's dozens of mathematical formulas and different ways of creating simulations and modeling forecasts that try to help predict the future. And it is also well known that forecasting within social sciences, of which DHS would fall into that area, is considered to be the most difficult, in large part because of the large numbers of factors that influence the forecast. And we'll go into a little bit about what some of those major factors are that influence the DHS populations. So as it notes here, that the more factors that influence it and the more quickly things change, the more difficult it is to create a forecast. It is also well known that the best practices actually combine forecast methods, which is what this unit has done. And then I thought you might be interested that we've been trying to contact other state social service agencies to find out how they go about forecasting and what's their accuracy rate and their methodologies, et cetera. And there's a great deal of variation, but on average, they range about plus or minus 4% from the actuals to the forecast. Our forecasts are in about that area. Some of them are closer, more like plus or minus 1%, and some of them have been larger than that. The smaller the groups, the larger the variations. Okay. Factors that influence DHS populations. I'm going to have to look at my notes for that. There's many of them, and a lot of these probably, I'm sure, are not a surprise. The first one on the left, the economy. While Oregon has been experiencing job growth and a slow but steady economic recovery. In fact, it was on the front page of the Statesman Journal this morning. Many of those jobs have been coming in either low-wage jobs or have not been offering health insurance benefits. And so there is not a one-to-one correspondence between our populations of the department and the economic growth. Job growth, wages, et cetera. While there is a tie, it's not one-to-one. Demographics of the state also impact our caseloads over time. So, for example, much has been mentioned today of age. And indeed, that is a factor, at least in a 10-year range. I was just told the other day that the first baby boomer turns 60 in January. So we still have that to look forward to for moving into, for example, the maybe the Medicare years, 65 plus, another 5 years a time. So there's also changes in demographics having to do with migration, in-migration and out-migration, health and disability. People may be living longer, but there's actually mixed information regarding what their health will be. Some studies have suggested that people, for example, may be using long-term care services at a later point, and others have said, well, no, the lifestyles are not better, and so they're not taking care of themselves, and so that actually the push into long-term care services may arise sooner than that. But all of those, the levels of disability and the health, all influence the DHS caseloads. Poverty levels influence DHS caseloads. That's connected with the minimum wage that's being paid, the types of jobs that are being paid, whether it's full-time or part-time work. All of those aspects have an influence on DHS caseload populations. The actual health insurance or the long-term care markets themselves also have an influence on DHS populations. If you think about it, over the past 5 to 10 years, there's been a steady decline in the number of small firms offering health insurance to their full-time employees. And if your economy is being funded or is kind of growing on with the small businesses, then that's going to have an impact that you can have people who are working and perhaps working part-time or full-time, but that doesn't necessarily translate into more health insurance. I think it's already been mentioned that we've actually had a growth in the last, since about 2000, in our uninsurance rates for both adults and children. There's also been an increase in the cost of premiums and health insurance premiums. Some of those have been passed on to the employees, but some of them have been borne by industries themselves, or they've simply stopped offering them. Policy changes also have a dramatic impact on DHS caseloads. And those policy changes can come at the federal level, or at the state level, or at the local level. Each one of them would have different effects. I'm trying to think of some of the policy changes that were mentioned earlier regarding OHP standard. Well, the change in the benefit package, the closure of the program, and a lot of the talk about those things have not just the policy changes, but then the kind of information that's around them all have an impact on the DHS caseloads. And that actually leads to the next piece of it, the outreach and education efforts. Because so many people come in the door, they may be coming in for one service, but they're also being evaluated if they need other social services. So, for example, when there's efforts at reducing hunger in Oregon, and people then begin to apply for food stamps. Well, as those applications are being evaluated, they're evaluated also for the needs of other kinds of social services, like health insurance or medical assistance. And so you will see that connection as well in a variety of different programs. The Medicare Modernization Act with the prescription drugs starting in January, that has also, there's been a lot of talk about it, and there can be additional people who will then seek health insurance, and they may, through our door as well, to get onto the Medicaid program. And so all of those have an impact on our efforts. There's a close connection here with the changes in DHS business practices and the policy changes. You know, how are those policy changes enacted? So how DHS operates, where those people come in the door, how their applications are processed, can have an impact as well. And then we also have cultural or individual behavior changes over time. For example, there may be changes in the, how people feel about applying for what they might call, you know, welfare, or how long they want to stay in their home before they move into a nursing home, because of the idea of they don't want to go into a nursing home. And those delays or those changes will also have an impact on DHS populations. So given that, given the complexity and given all the different factors that influence the populations, et cetera, DHS, as I mentioned before, does use combined methods, both that work into that science as well as the art. And these are actually, when we get to the genius, that's actually a term in the forecasting. It's called genius, which I like. But the science of it is that we use a variety of mathematical models to create modeling or simulation of what we think is going to occur into the future. It's a very complex model, and I won't go into any great depth, but I will describe it in a little bit more depth in just a moment here. And then the art of it is that we also gather the consensus of program and technical experts on factors that may be influencing it, or actually taking a look at what those forecasts might look like, what those simulations would look like, and then making a choice. Well, we think that the best representative historical period to move forward on, you know, is here. And so it's a gathering of those experts together to try to help formulate what that what the direction is. The genius is the kind of the intuition or the expertise of the forecasters themselves and the other program people. And we do try to combine those efforts to create the best forecast that we can. I mentioned the mathematical model, so I just wanted to go into a little bit about what that is. Is it looks at historical patterns, and the patterns that it's, that the mathematical models are tracking are the numbers of clients coming into the program, new, the number, how long they may stay in the program. Because if you have changes in how long they stay, for example, if all of a sudden people start to stay in the program longer, then you have a greater cumulative effect over time, as well as the clients transitioning among the related programs or leaving the program altogether. So what we try to do is, for example, we would divide the Oregon Health Plan up into many different groups and then look at movements between, for example, of their patterns of people moving from this program to this other program and then back again. So it's measuring that and then trying to create some predictions based on that. I also did want to add that many of those factors that influence the DHS caseload are actually very, very difficult to put into mathematical models, because while we know they may be happening, you don't know by how much, by how long, et cetera. And so you have to have those kind of numbers in order to plug them into mathematical models. That's why a lot of that needs to be done outside of that model, the mathematical models, or adjustments need to be made. We are working on trying to target that particular area for further development and seeing if there's other ways that we could incorporate some of those factors in to be able to predict out in the future the DHS populations. As I mentioned, we do look at the various factors that influence the program's caseloads, and when we are able to make adjustments to the mathematical models, we do so. However, sometimes what we need to do is provide the research and the backgrounds and say, well, this is a potential that's coming down the road. We think it will have this kind of an impact that that the DHS program experts and other folks who need to make those kind of decisions, they need to know about that as far as, and we describe those as kind of risks to the forecast itself. We do that on the basis of the gathering of consensus of the program experts as well as the technical experts that are outside of DHS. And then our own staff also conducts research on national and state trends that may have that influence. Oh, that was it. So there's my contact information. So on your hard copy, you have that. If you have questions about our models or methods or questions about our processes, you can contact me there either via phone or our email address. And now I'd like to move on to the excellent.
Thank you, Mr. Cochero. Judy, thank you for your presentation, and I know that the modeling of how this all works and getting it into statistical data is very, very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But again, and to Jim as well, I would hope that when you provide us with this budgetary information to, again, build on our base of knowledge, that you could include information that you could tell us what percent of the budgets within this DHS cluster are forecasted versus non-forecasted budgets, the dollar amount and percentage of the total DHS, so that we know. Because for this committee's benefit, you know, when you're talking about billions of dollars in budget and we say we're off by 4%, and that might be the standard, and we may be measuring within the standard of other states, and then we pick up the newspaper and read that DHS has a $100 million hole in it somewhere.
Yeah.
We need to understand the scope, the size that we're dealing with here, and that a 4% error is catastrophic in terms of total dollars within the state budget. So I want to try to get the committee's hands around the size we're dealing with, and if we can know which of those budgets are forecasted and which are not, and how they could have the total impact of whatever the percentage of error is, critically important that you know, we understand that. And then my second comment, and again, this may not be for today, but when you, Judy, spoke of the external review process and those that help you with the external review process, and again, my experience has been with DHS from a Ways and Means perspective during the last session, forecasting and the ability to come real close on forecasting has been a major component of the budgetary missteps that we've had here. In the past, in the most recent past, what has the comment or what has the review of your forecasting, those folks from the external standpoint that, you know, they're not doing your review, I'm guessing they are measuring how you have done on review. What have they said about review, given that in the last e-board and the last session, a lot of our problem was from forecasting, or as the agency reported, you know, hey, we missed the forecast by X amount. Have these folks said, hey, you're doing a great job, or have they said, hey, you're missing by a wide margin? What has their review been?
Representative Hannah, those outside experts provide oversight and review, and largely it's been of the methods and trying to help the department refine the methods that are being used to come up with more accurate forecasts. They actually have not made a comment at this point on, you know, our accuracy as far as whether we're doing a good job or not doing a good job, in those particular meetings. So many of them are forecasters themselves and sort of understand a lot of those complexities, and their goal is to try to help us improve that over time.
Follow up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Follow up.
If that hasn't been done, then I might be thinking out loud, if you only have other folks for external review who are helping you get there, but we don't have the bar set someplace, we still need to find a way to review and say, are we hitting the mark? Is 4% an acceptable level? Or 3 or 2? I mean, a way to review your forecasting, in a
right.
sense, so that we have a measurement of, are the folks that we're asking to do this the best that they can be at doing it, and can we provide more help, or just where are we? We need to be able to measure that, in my mind.
Right. And I, Representative Hanna, I believe we're still working on improving the process as well as, you know, what the roles are of those particular individuals. And indeed, we will bring that up to them.
Great. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a little bit of a follow-up to Representative Hanna. First question, and I assume the answer is four, but what is your frequency of forecasting? And the reason I say four is because I'm looking at fall 2005. Is it four times a year, or is it?
It's the chairs and Representative Brun. No, it's done twice a year.
Twice a year.
Actually,
okay.
There's a fall forecast and a spring forecast.
Okay. Okay.
And we're at the process right now where we're getting ready to work on the spring forecast. We're in the early stages of gathering information, et cetera. So we're already moving along to the spring forecast.
My second question, Mr.
Follow-up.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, as was mentioned, we see the big case issues with DHS under-forecasting, underestimating, if you will, by $100 million what the caseload's going to be. My question, I realize that the goal in the national norm is plus or minus 1 to 4%, or 4%, we've been better than that at times. When we are wrong, when DHS is wrong in the forecasting over recent history, and you can call recent history the last 2 to 5 years, on which side of that have we been wrong? Have we always been wrong by underestimating, or has it been a mix of overestimating and underestimating?
Co-chairs and Representative Brun, it's actually been a mix of both, right? And our unit as a whole has only been in existence for a year.
Oh, I gotcha.
And so we haven't had that long of an experience to gather
gotcha.
That much error experience yet. But it actually is a mix of both over and under.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Geisler.
Thank you, Chair. I noticed that the developmental disability programs are not part of your forecasting unit. Why is that, and does that put at a disadvantage the accuracy of a very large and costly and important function of DHS if it's not forecast in the same way as the other DHS programs?
Co-chairs and Representative Gelser, the developmental disabilities program actually has relative, when we're talking about the overall numbers of people, has a relatively small population, although you are correct that the dollars that would go along with that are quite high. In the case of development disabilities, we've had difficulties with their accessing the data that's needed to run the statistical methods on those. There's efforts within the department to improve those data systems, but they've been occurring over the last year and not in time to be able to work on those forecasts at this time. There is once the data systems are more readily available and have more accurate data that tracks people coming in and out, then we will move to do that forecast as well. Meantime, if that's done outside of the forecasting our particular unit, but it is done by the department. It's just within the program areas.
Okay, thank you.
Before you move on, mm-hmm. a couple of comments. First comment that I would have is I'm not terribly sympathetic with the rationale frequently given in the quote-unquote social science type of measurement. I'm not because it ignores, in fact, this very same problem in any other scientific measurement. And I would give as an example a good friend of mine who's chairman of Department of Physics at a major university in this country, or was, who was explaining to me on a trip one time about this grandiose thing that he was doing, when it was completed, he'd get a Nobel Prize for it because it would be the greatest thing since sliced bread in the world of physics. But his only problem was that he had this thing that he was supposed to, that he had to measure. And every time he went to measure it, for those with science background, it would not be a big surprise, every time he went to measure it, it changed. And as a consequence, he never got the Nobel Prize in physics because the darn thing kept changing and he never got an answer to where he was at. And so, to me, it's always a little bit of a cop-out on the part of the peer review group that that you have, who are quote-unquote experts in this field, that I'm not terribly sympathetic with, because everybody else in science has the same problem. It may in sometimes be degrees, be that as it may. The forecasting, however you're doing, I think, colleagues, as has been mentioned, we're going to have to allow a certain amount of patience with the group, because at least it is a step, in my opinion, in the right direction, in trying to get a handle on. We may have to make some adjustments. They may have to make some adjustments. Mm-hmm. And that is part of the process of forecasting. So I also found and this is a totally off-the-wall comment that you'll get accustomed to as you serve with me in this task force. The discussion you put on policy and policy effect upon what takes place in the, and I would submit for you that the spotted owl as a policy had a dramatic effect on the caseload for DHS as well as other social service RE education, I would suggest that the policy that we would not draw down the dams during the summer months had an effect on OMAP, because employers in my district, that's one of the things they can drop when the cost of their electricity goes up. They can drop their health insurance. And RE, therefore, now that it's another debate whether that's a policy, but to ignore the effect of policy on caseload like this, is to ignore the reality of the world that we live in. So much for that. And you will hear that again.
Mr. Chair, it is all interrelated. That is definitely the case. And in regards to the difficulties of forecasting within the social sciences, I was just wanted to comment that, you were mentioning earlier about shooting for the moon. Well, I think that perhaps we could shoot for, getting a Nobel prize in economics by learning to forecast social populations better.
If we could improve that to the 98th or to a 2% error, we would be in line for.
And many of our programs are actually within the 2%, but it's within, when you break it down, it can vary widely. I wanted to move on to the actual forecast, the fall 2005 forecast for the medical assistance programs. And I'm going to go over it in relatively quickly and try to draw your attention to some of the highlights or some of the main trends that we're seeing from at least the fall forecast. Okay. What we do is we break the Oregon Health Plan into various population groupings. First of all, it's the breaking down into whether it's OHP Standard, OHP Plus, or these other medical assistance programs. And then, for example, within OHP Plus, there's many subgroups within that. So I'm actually going to cover that first. What we've seen with the fall 2005 forecast in breaking it down is that we're going to see, or we're predicting that we're going to see a general continual increase overall in the Oregon Health Plan populations, particularly in the area of OHP plus populations. One of the smaller populations that we'll be predicting will increase are those that are in the age of the blind and age of the disabled categories. There was about a two-year time period in which it was a kind of a leveling off, and in the recent times we've seen another increase. When we've kind of delved into that and tried to figure out what's been perhaps leading to that recent increase, is that for that two-year time period, what you'll note is that there's a kind of a blip up. I probably should put the pages. I was doing this without the pages. There was a blip up in January of 2003, which is related to the closure of the general assistance programs as well as the medically needy programs. Many of those people were moved into the age of the blind and the disabled categories if they qualified. And what happened is then over those two-year time period, we wound up with more people leaving the program, in large part because it was those general assistance folks were leaving the program faster than their counterparts. And so we had more people leaving than coming in, or it was about even. So we saw a general flat line. Now that it's like that policy change of having closed that program has now worked its way through the whole system now, and now we're seeing, going back to those that period of growth, we're seeing very similar trends in growth as to what we saw before the closure of the general assistance program. There's a general agreement amongst the program experts that is likely to continue. Within the children populations, which would be the poverty level medical children as well as the CHIP children, which is the Children's Health Insurance Program, we are seeing a rise in the CHIP program and kind of a leveling off of the poverty level medical children. Those groupings, the CHIP children have slightly higher, their families have slightly higher incomes. They're between either 133 to 185% of the federal poverty level, or between 100 to 185% of the federal poverty level. We've also seen several different outreach efforts within the FEOP program to engage people who are working, et cetera, on the FEOP program.
Page 5.
Oh, thank you. Page 5. That was very nice of you, Jim. And 5 moves.
Judy?
Children. Page 15, and then later. Yes?
Can I ask you to try to get through by about 10 feet?
I intend on being sooner than that.
I thought you got 5 of them. Getting through 6 and that thing up here. But if we could.
I don't expect to spend a lot more time on this. And really, I'm doing an overview of the overall findings and not necessarily walking you through the whole book. Within the CHIP program, It's likely that the outreach efforts among the FEOP program, which is targeting people who are working, that did draw in additional people or children into the CHIP program as well. We also have seen some growth in the foster children, which it's growing. The foster children is growing at a faster rate on the medical assistance programs than the general child population in the state. And there's some anecdotal evidence, at least right now, that is related to the meth epidemic in Oregon. It's also nationwide. Temporary assistance in needy families. We are actually seeing a great deal of growth in that particular program in both the TANF, what's called the TANF-related medical, as well as in the TANF extended programs. We are also seeing,
We were seeing growth in the old age assistance programs. However, within the old age assistance programs, there were some policy changes made for seniors that had an impact on the number of people who were covered under the Oregon Health Plan who would have been in that program. And what we saw was a dramatic drop and then kind of a flattening out, and that's also paralleled within the seniors program. I don't need to go into OHP standard other than because Jim's already covered that, and I don't need to cover the other programs, medical assistance programs either, if we'd like to have some additional time. So I can leave it there, and if you have questions, you can ask.
Quick question, Mr. Chair. Where does Oregon Project Independence fall? Does it fall into the old age assistance program that's listed here?
Do we have seniors, people here? Do you know, they don't get that medical assistance, right? I'm sorry.
That's okay.
That's all my answer. Co-chairs, Representative Brenn, Oregon Project Independence, those individuals do not qualify for the Oregon Health Plan. And so they're actually... they're not actually included in the either in the seniors forecast, the one that we do, that our unit does, but that they wouldn't be counted in this population.
Sure. I think, Representative, that basically the types of services provided by OPI would otherwise be provided under the Oregon Health Plan. Therefore, in some way, maybe a different sort of.
I was just curious if it fell into this old age assistance program, not necessarily under the OHP. So.
And that's been its one of its problems for us in the legislature is that it has generally been 100% generally, but it's been 100% general fund funding.
Right.
Even though the dollars are small, 100% funding is a difficult item compared to when you're. It's 25-75, right. 75 being, you know. But
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we do draw down about 62% federal money for most of our programs, and even higher than that, about 73% federal money in our CHIP program. So it does pay to provide things through the Medicaid program when we can, but that is a 100% general funded program.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Judy, Representative Hanna, I believe, was touching on this, but I wanted to clarify. Are there long-term cost projections that are completed based on this caseload forecasting? Did you touch on that?
Co-Chairs and Representative Shields, I did not touch on that because this is on the caseload side of it. The budget analysts are working on what that impact would be, and I'm assuming that they'll be bringing that forward soon.
Okay. We will be dealing with that. Any other? Having made my previous comments, let me conclude on this with a comment that I do appreciate this initial effort at forecasting that we have here. I do think we may have to be a little bit patient with it and make adjustments to it as it goes along, but at least we'll have some basis on which to make those adjustments rather than just simply, oh my gosh, we've got a crisis, we've got to do something now. And I think we probably will have somewhere along the line, future line, some discussions on the whole that has been referred to a time or two today. And not necessarily that this will eliminate that, but hopefully will minimize some of that in the future, although I think... we probably all have a lot of explanations or theories that we might have about that, but that does remain for a later session for us, I think. Nothing else?
good luck.
Go. We do have...
You did mention at the beginning that I've been on this job 2 weeks longer than Bruce has been on his.
Well, you are ready to...
You're the expert.
You
know,
by definition, then, you're an expert. Yeah. We do have Catherine, is that right? Pfeiffer, for public comment?
She stepped out of
the building. She stepped out of the building?
Yes.
Out of the room? Fetter?
I don't.
Want to look for it?
Oh. Sure, I don't. The name's not familiar to me.
Yeah.
And then if you just want to...
Well...
We have a letter for the record.
Oh, we have a letter, too, here from... Bradley King, Vice President and Chief Financial Officer from OHSU, that would become a part of the official record, and we would ask you to read it and reserve perhaps any comment for the next meeting, if there's any that you have on it. And while we're waiting for the public comment, then...
I don't know who she is.
I do know her, but I can't see her out in the hall.
She may be dropping back in a second. So let's go ahead with our review and discussion of the proposed task force work plan. What comments you all may have. I think you've had this for some time now. And if you have any suggestions... any comments? This will be a work in progress throughout the entirety of this task force. And let me make one kind of initial point of clarification as far as how the task force will be run. The co-chairs will change the gavel every other meeting sort of thing. So Representative Hannah will be the co-chair at the next meeting, etc., down the line as we go through this. Unless that would be possible that one of us might want to chair a particular segment, and you'd give us, I hope, the liberty to make those changes as we chose to do. Between the two of us. Is there any other questions, discussion, any concerns about the agenda? Anything you want to add that we don't have on the agenda?
It's very rigorous already.
Well, anything you want to complete? We have to, in a major part, blame Sandy for how rigorous it is. She's a real slave driver. Taskmaster. And those of you who haven't had the privilege of serving on a committee with Sandy in the past will certainly appreciate her professionalism that she brings to us. Okay.
And Mr. Chair, as a follow-up, just to let you know that the topics that are identified on the work plan are just the topics. Expect the agenda will be far more detailed directed so that if there are particulars of that specific topic that you want to spend a little bit of time on, by all means, just, you know, fire that off to me or the co-chairs, either the co-chairs, and we'll make sure that it gets covered under the appropriate area. Any organization or individual or association that you'd like to hear a presentation from, et cetera, et cetera. We welcome your feedback on that also.
Okay, did you want to talk about scheduling?
Well, I passed out the calendars. I know there's been requests during different interims that we schedule meetings out a little further than a month at a time. So we're trying to take that approach, seeing as how people do have lives in the interim and are not here every day. I know. Every day of the week, like in session. So we just wanted to put that on the table for discussion. If you want to schedule a January, February meeting out, But I understand if you folks don't have your immediate, you know, schedules with you to compare dates, I didn't know how you wanted to move forward. So it's just an option.
Could I suggest maybe sending out two or three options via email and having us respond to them in a timely manner? So vote on them, if you will, on the next two or three meetings?
Sure.
Because you're exactly right, Cindy. I mean, this is great, but I don't have my calendar.
I know.
Might I make a suggestion here to your point, Representative Bruin? And I, this morning, having not communicated this with Sandy, but I walked in, handed her a note, and said, here's dates that don't work for me in the January, February, March period. And so I think it's a lot easier if you'd each fill in your calendar and say, these dates don't work at all, because to your point, Representative Bruin, that way if you do send an email out, you know ahead of time this date's not going to work for half the people. So if we eliminate the dates that don't work, she can work towards using dates that do fit or possibly fit in the most calendars. And like today, with two members missing, likely you're going to have a difficult time getting everybody, but we'd like to have the best participation possible.
And as a follow-up, I try and do committees, like you might have noticed on the member chart, where your other obligations are, too, to try and minimize expenses for per diem, especially for the long-distance folks. And also, just as a footnote, this isn't necessarily an issue that you all need to track, but I'm staffing five interim committees. So I can already tell you on January, the week of e-board is already getting pretty full. Just because of the two of the other task forces that I'm staffing. So within that, it's not only your priority of dates, but then the sooner we get on the books, the sooner we have less competition. We're sharing the building with the Marion County Courthouse. So we are very limited with our structured hearing rooms as well. That's ongoing. We thought it was only going to be for 30 days. Needless to say, that's been bumped to like April. Right. On a local level. So we're competing for just our logistics, too. The sooner we get on the books, the less we have to fight for what we want.
If we subcontract out our DHS forecasters for the local level, do you suppose we get some money from the county to do that?
Gosh, I don't know. It's, you know, it's an RFP or an interagency agreement type thing. So I those are just little footnotes that in scheduling, you know, and looking at your dates, but we'll do our best. And like I said, on the work plan today was a half a day just as an initial, but pretty much all the rest of them will be full days. So in looking at your schedules, let me know what absolutely doesn't work for you for all days. Thank you.
We are
our public comments.
Thank you, Representative. We are trying, as Sandy has indicated, to be conscious of other times you're going to be in the building, not only for the budgetary side of it, which is important, but also I think it makes it easier for you to, you know, or me or anyone to kind of schedule a couple of days rather than just one day this week and then, you know, one day next week or 2 days next week and one of those days on Monday and the other one on Thursday. I mean, you know, so we're trying to take all of those things into consideration as we arrange the schedule. And so Bruce's comment is really helpful. It would be helpful, Sandy, on that. Do we have anything else for the good of the order on our review and discussion of the work plan and where we're going? Any questions about that?
Just to clarify, since this is my first interim, in terms of committee legislation proposed to file, does that happen as part of the process? Or I noticed from the schedule there's a possible seventh meeting to look at particular pre-session legislation we might want to propose.
Sandy, do you, I'm not sure. In a regular committee, that is, it would be you do have committee legislation. I'm not sure what the protocol is for task force.
Same thing.
Okay.
And
we may have then proposed legislation, and we certainly encourage you all to to be thinking about that. So, yes.
Thank you.
And as a follow-up on that also, the procedurally at task force or committee pre-session filing deadline is in December. So as soon as we, the task force, have concepts that we want council to start looking at and drafting, we can do that, but we have up until the legislature has the last deadline for pre-session filing of all the other requirements, and usually it's the last Friday before Christmas, or it might even be the last Friday before the New Year. But being how we try and take care of it at our last meeting for any work session, so folks don't have to come back just to introduce legislation.
Great.
So,
sure.
Absolutely.
Okay. And I see our public comment lady is here, and we would ask that. Is it Mr. Fitter?
Piper.
Oh, okay.
Is that okay with you? Okay.
Oh, that's fine.
First of all, I'd like to thank the committee for your indulgence. While forecasting Oregon Health Plan caseworkers, you know, over 3 years, 5 years, during the interim process, it's always sometimes difficult to figure out how much parking meter money you're going to have to forecast. But that said, thank you for allowing us to be here. My name is Catherine Pfeiffer. I live in Portland, Oregon, and currently I am the Covering Kids and Families Project Coordinator for the Oregon Health Action Campaign. Our focus with respect to this particular project is to work to get eligible uninsured kids covered by any plan possible, generally FEOP, the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, or one of the publicly funded health care plans with the Oregon Health Plan. Plum, CHIP, or TANF, and also to help reduce enrollment barriers. And they come on a variety of different levels. The Oregon Health Action Campaign, very briefly, we are a coalition of individuals, organizations working for access to quality, affordable health care for all people. Today I am here on behalf of at the behest of my director, Ellen Penny of OHAC, who's dealing with a dental emergency of her father-in-law. We have been active in the development with the many revisions of the Oregon Health Plan since its inception. And as its most basic and as its most crude, the Oregon Health Plan and FEOP are vehicles for drawing down substantially large amounts of federal money to provide health care for Oregon's medically and economically vulnerable. Their numbers are growing at the same time that the federal commitment may be shrinking. OHAC, we do not believe that either caseload growth or potentially shrinking federal contributions are the reasons to back off a commitment to providing health access for the medically and economically vulnerable. We believe that public financial investment in health programs for the economically and medically vulnerable serve both to prevent cost shift to the private sector and, two, to provide great economic and health returns to Oregon's urban and rural communities. We are beyond delighted that the legislature has set up a committee to explore the Oregon Health Plan, and we appreciate this opportunity for public comment. We regret that this committee does not include any Senate members. As you ponder the future of Oregon's Medicaid, the Oregon Health Plan, and its FEOP programs, we would like to ask that you keep the following in mind. First, Oregon needs to spend public resources on health plans and health care for the medically and economically vulnerable in the most cost-effective way possible. We believe that to mean maximizing federal contribution and utilizing all of our CHIP money, Children's Health Insurance Program. To give you a quick example, this year, $47 million in CHIP money is available to Oregon. It used to be that if we don't use this year's allocation in 3 years, we lose it. And we understand that Congress has or is moving to place it where it is only going to be a two-year use or lose. Since Oregon started receiving CHIP, we have returned to the federal government the following funds. In 2000, we returned $6.7 million. 2001, we returned $21 million. 2002, we returned $14 million. And in 2003, we returned $25 million. And that is only for CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Assistance Program. In addition, to keep in mind, the third point is ensuring that all capitated health plans provide access to the Oregon Health Plan and are covered with prioritized services. Not all Medicaid managed care plans are created equal. DHS should ensure that all plans provide timely access to the Oregon Health Plan covered services, and where they do not, the state should no longer contract with those plans. Fee per service may well be less costly when that is the case, and return the access should that be required. The Oregon Health Plan and FEOP, they simply can't be separated. They use the same money and target the same populations. The question you can ask about the Oregon Health Plan must be asked about FEOP as well. Administrative cost, marketing cost, impact of copays and premiums on access to care for the targeted populations. The per member per month cost of FEOP enrollees in the high risk pool, the Oregon Medical Insurance pool, versus per member per month cost of standard OHP. The income level of FEOP enrollees versus the income level of Oregon Health Plan enrollees. Oregon, we need you to explore how and to what extent Oregon's large employers are relying on publicly funded health programs as the benefit packages for their employees dwindle. OHP was never intended as a public partnership only. It was intended as a public/private partnership. FEOP fulfills only a small part of that intent. By far, FEOP's biggest enrollment is in the individual market, not the group market. We also understand that other states have public disclosure of large employer utilization of publicly funded health programs. Oregon, we do not have that. The question to ask is simple, and we encourage this committee to ask it. Which Oregon employers have more than 25 employees enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan or in the FEOP individual market? Thank you very much for your time. And do any of the committee members, do you have any questions or additional comments?
Question? Covered it right across the board.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for bringing your testimony to us, and we'll look forward to seeing you again throughout the interim.
Thank you for having us.
Okay.
I just wondered, would that be testimony be available in hard copy?
Oh, do we have it? Okay.
Are you going to run copies now, Sandy? Okay, we will. If there's nothing else for the agenda, for the good of the order, we will close our first interim meeting of the session. Thank you all very much for being here. We'll look forward to working with you.